Hello, listeners, and welcome to La Pausa Pod for what is going to be somewhat of an existential journey through the Champions League quarterfinal second legs, and an existential journey for Spanish football in general. From Atletico's reckoning to Barcelona's unraveling and Real Madrid's inexplicable excellence, it's been a weird couple of nights this week, where at one stage it felt like we were going to have an all-Spanish semi-final, and then at least one of the two was going to go through. And then, as it turns out, neither of the Spanish teams made it through on the Tuesday night, Atletico Madrid and Barcelona falling. And then it was just a crazy night on Wednesday in Manchester as Real Madrid gave us the full Real Madrid experience. I got a message from Jamie after that game. He said, "These Real Madrid ties send my head for a spin every season." And I was just thinking, that's exactly how I feel. It's 70% just incredible to watch, and 30% of you is left wondering, does anything make any sense anymore? How did you enjoy the games, Jamie?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is with Real Madrid and these Champions League ties is I feel like I'm being lazy and just repeating myself every single season. You know, falling back on the DNA stuff, the fact they're bulletproof in the Champions League and they just cannot be beaten. Obviously, that's not true, but it's just the way it feels. And yeah, I think after I watched it back again, I definitely had more of an appreciation for the way Real Madrid defended. Not that I didn't first time, of course, but yeah, second time, you know, the organization, the synergy between the way that they were defending both sides of the pitch, with, you know, midfielders helping out, dropping into the back line, so many details that they just got perfectly. Obviously, we know, you know, if you're going to play a Champions League tie, you would rather have the 30 plus shots versus whatever Real Madrid had. But, you know, with the cards they were dealt on the night, they just bunkered down and said, right, we'll claw our way to the semi-finals.
That's exactly what Carlo Ancelotti said. He said it was the only way that he felt that they could get out of the tie alive, which is understandable. And that's exactly how I feel, that it's a very strange feeling. And I wasn't sure if I was the only one feeling it, because on one hand, while we're not fans of any of the clubs that we talk about, really, we try to remain unbiased. You do like seeing the Spanish clubs getting through, just for practicality sake, so we'll have something to talk about, and so that we'll have something, an interest, a specific interest in it. But it's very strange watching Real Madrid when, like you said there, part of you is like, oh wow, this is just incredible, and there's another part when you're like, it doesn't make any sense to me. I watched a game with a mate of mine, and before the game kicked off, I said listen, the caveat to all this is that it's Real Madrid and anything could happen here, and they always have a chance. But logically speaking, Manchester City are the red hot favourites here, and in a logical world, they'll beat Real Madrid relatively easily here, because when you think about it, Real Madrid scraped the draw. We'll say scraped the draw at the Bernabeu, and then they lose Tchouaméni from that starting 11. Manchester City added Ederson, added Walker, and added Kevin De Bruyne after the draw, and they're playing at home. And I was thinking, logically speaking, now look, and he said, but Madrid, and I was like, no, look, I know, I'm fully aware of that. But yeah, we're gonna we've kind of kicked off now talking about that, but let's work our way through it and start with Barcelona first, who lost 4-1 on the night to PSG, 6-4 on aggregate, and Ronald Araujo's sending off in the first half really was the turning point here. There was a bit of a debate in the press conference after. Luis Enrique said, "I think we would have beaten them anyway, even if Araujo didn't get sent off." Xavi says, "I'm not entirely sure if that's the case. I don't agree with him. I think we were defending well. I think that we were finding chances, and I think we would have been able to hold on, and we would have potentially been able to win the game." Regardless, we don't know about that. The bottom line is that Ronald Araujo was sent off, and this was a Barcelona capitulation, pretty much. It's the end of, I don't know what era it is, but it certainly feels like the end of something now after that game.
Yeah, I don't think I was quite as annoyed as Xavi about the red card, but watching as, you know, a neutral or watching from, kind of hoping Barca would get through just for the podcast, like you said, it was really disappointing that the red card happened. The tie was set up so nicely for Barcelona. And I just wanted to see how Xavi would react to the problem that PSG had posed them early on. Obviously, they had the 1-0 lead by then, but it was clear from the very start of the game that how Araujo managed the ball was going to be a big topic in this match. And he struggled initially. You know, we'll probably talk about how Luis Enrique kind of teed up the game with, you know, playing him into trouble, getting him sent off. But yeah, I wanted to see how Xavi would react because, you know, the tactical problem that obviously they left Araujo open, man marked every other midfielder and said, Araujo, you make the decisions here. And it was a case of Luis Enrique picking on him a little bit with his possession work. But yeah, it just felt like the red card, it ruined the tie. And quite honestly, I felt it was over at that point. I didn't see how Barcelona could manage retaining the ball and keeping a defensive shape that wouldn't give up chances simultaneously. Yeah, I have to admit, I don't think Xavi had a great night individually, but I felt it was kind of over at that point.
Yeah, it was Ronald Araujo's ball out to Lamine Yamal for the opening goal. And then it was also a pass from Ronald Araujo that started the move for the sending off too. I felt like the way that Barcelona set themselves up, this was only a matter of time. And in a way, okay, it's an individual incident, but it was a result of the way that Barcelona in some ways set up. Lamine Yamal was playing really narrow, and Mendes, the left back for PSG, was out wide, and Fabian Ruiz was pulling out wide too, which was kind of dragging Pedri across, and then Koundé was having to go out to him, and there was this channel open between Koundé and Araujo that was they were just going to keep on exploiting it, and I think it was actually going to become more pronounced as the game went on. As a result, it wasn't a direct result of that they got the goal and they broke through, but Barcola was looking dangerous from the very start anyway. So Xavi didn't cover himself in glory either with the red card, and it just feels like Luis Enrique, the pressure that he was putting Barcelona under, they had no real response to it, and they got cut out, and then they got opened up for four goals.
Yeah, it's to listen to Luis Enrique before the game, I was just thinking, this guy is so mischievous and intelligent in the way he can kind of prepare a game before it's even begun in the press conference. It made me laugh that he said, we're going there and we're going to press from the first minute. And then he kind of dropped in and then they'll resort to long balls. And to me, that was kind of trying to convince them to not resort to long balls and to put the ball at risk, because I felt Luis Enrique knew he had a plan that would disrupt Barcelona, and at the feet of Araujo and forcing him to be the one that decides was going to be a problem for Barcelona, and it certainly was. It reminded me of kind of like an NBA playoff game, where teams will, if you're not a good shooter from 3-point range, teams will just leave you open in the playoffs and say, we're going to protect this side. And if you can make the shot, then fine, we'll live with it. But we're going to bank on you not being able to make the shot. And to me, it felt exactly like what they did with Araujo. They said, we're going to pick on the weakest defender. Everybody else is marked, and you're going to make a decision, and we're going to bank on the fact you're going to make a mistake more times than you're going to punish us. So, yeah, again, I think Luis Enrique deserves credit for the way the red card happened.
And it's actually incredible to think that between Cubarsí, the teenager, and Araujo, which one of those do you want to pick as your the player you're going to target, and they don't pick the 17-year-old. It's it just goes to show just how incredible Kumar C has been. You'd think he would be the weak bullet point all day, but he's clearly not. And yeah, and then there was the penalty. And yeah, just a stat here from this game, a player who caught most people's eyes during the game, Vitinha, he got the goal too. He completed 96% of his passes under pressure in the UEFA Champions League knockout stages this season. 212 of 222. It's the highest percentage of any midfielder with a minimum of 100 passes. He was particularly impressive throughout the both ties, really.
Yeah, loved watching him play. Not a player I've seen a lot of, to be honest, but I do know I do know somebody who follows Portuguese football very closely who speaks highly of him. And yeah, just to me, it felt like you're watching the midfielder that should have been playing for Barcelona in the stereotypical version of Barcelona midfielder. I didn't want to make it a thing of, you know, picking on Frenkie de Jong or whatever, but again, just watching Vitinha play, knowing he cost, you know, half the fee that de Jong did, the way that he doesn't really hold onto the ball as much as de Jong does. He finds the passes, he plays a good rhythm. But as you say, barely ever lost the ball in this tie. I know they played against 10 men in the second leg, but again, during the knockout stages, Real Sociedad tried to press them really aggressively in both. And again, the guy just doesn't lose the ball. Keeps it moving. And yeah, he's just a very productive player in midfield and really impressed with him behind, you know, the front three that are kind of the face of this PSG team. In the knockout stages, if you don't have midfielders that can take the ball and manage it in the most difficult areas, you're going to struggle. So yeah, really impressed with him.
Yeah, and I think it was clear that usually around this time of the year is my annual reminder of how much I enjoyed watching Marco Verratti play, because I wouldn't watch PSG and then I get to see him in the Champions League and I'm just like, he's just so good. But Luis Enrique was very clear with Verratti in the summer that he didn't really rely on him. And obviously he knew what he had in Vitinha. He's a slightly more dynamic version of that. And Luis Enrique, that's what he needs from his midfielders. And yeah, it looks like now they play Dortmund and they'll be the favourites for that. Although I wasn't entirely convinced with them throughout the two legs, given the fact that even though Barcelona were down to 10 men, had their manager sent off and then another assistant sent off on top of that and were just going unraveling, Barcelona were still in with a shot like relatively late in the second half, and they couldn't really finish them off as convincingly as I thought they might have had. And that sounds strange to say given the fact that they won 4-1 in the end, but I still think there probably are question marks over PSG, but they do play Dortmund now in the semi-final and they'll be favourites for that. And then Real Madrid played Bayern in the other semi-final and that's probably a 50-50, but every chance Real Madrid gets through. And then we're looking at a Luis Enrique versus Real Madrid Champions League final, and that is just Luis Enrique's dream.
Yeah,
it's just his dream.
Forget
Mbappe. But yeah, they're not Luis. No, Luis Enrique. I'll just be. He won't even. He'll know he's not the protagonist. This the Spanish word protagonist. But he'll just be on the sidelines saying little things. He'll be twitching. Is that a verb? I don't know. It is now. He'll be on Twitch and he'll be talking and he'll be just loving it. And
yeah.
It's just his dream.
I want it just for the press conference alone.
Yeah. And then afterwards, win, lose, or draw, Luis Enrique will have plenty to say. So yeah, that's that one pretty much wrapped up. And it'll be interesting now to see. There's been a lot of fallout after the game with Gundogan being critical of Araujo, saying you can't give the referee the chance to send you off there. Because while I do think it was harsh, I think if the referee doesn't give a red card there, PSG have more to complain about than Barcelona have to complain about with the red card. I think the referee would have been just not giving the red card in order to not ruin the tie. And that's what the referee can't be there for. He needs to call every individual event as he sees it. And the fact that Araujo probably, I think, could have gotten away with just the arm on the shoulder, but then he kind of gets his legs tangled up a little bit and it looks just so awkward, and it's like you have to give a red card for that, and I know it ruined the tie, but that's it. Anyway, we're going to leave Barcelona for now because we have a very special guest coming up after the weekend, after the Clásico, and we're going to talk more about Barcelona and where this leaves them and we just what to make of what's currently happening there. And we'll move on now to Borussia Dortmund versus Atletico Madrid. Another disappointing game, given the fact that Atletico Madrid were leading 2-1 coming into the leg. They went down 2-0 and then came back, and it felt like there's no way they lose it from here. And they ended up losing 4-2 on the night. Not even by, they didn't even get to manage to get to extra time. They lost the entire tie. And this was, I don't really know where to start, but Jan Oblak's shot stopping just wasn't where it needed to be. They conceded 4 from 1.9 XG. I'm not sure about the second goal, but the first one certainly, he probably needs to do a little bit better. But just all around defensively weak from Atletico Madrid, which is a trait of this team now. And it's worrying. It's not an easy fix. And I don't know where Simeone goes from here either.
No, I mean, it must be one of the most painful exits he's had in the Champions League, because I don't want to make this a thing of La Liga versus Bundesliga or, you know, compare the levels, but I do not see Borussia Dortmund as a semi-final level team. The way, I mean, to concede 4 goals in a Champions League knockout stage game, only the second time it's happened under Simeone, and the other was the 2014 final against Real Madrid, which obviously went to extra time. So again, they've collapsed under the weight of a team who I wasn't overly impressed with on both ends, really. And again, the debate comes back to Atletico first leg. They built their advantage through being aggressive, playing on the front foot, provoking mistakes. Second leg, as we said, I think I remember saying last week that I expected them just to come with the old school Simeone stuff this time. Know that they had a one goal lead and just kind of not hope for the best, but bank on themselves to be able to defend better in a more, you know, in a higher stakes game where the concentration levels are better. But from minute one, that lack of getting up to the ball, pressing, being aggressive, just seems to manifest as a total lack of aggression in the performance overall. Obviously, they changed that at half time, but yeah, the first half just really disappointing to be, what was it, two down at half time, and having to make those radical changes to bring the game back. So yeah, a very painful one for Atletico.
Yeah, and we posted a couple of stats on Twitter after the game, and there's plenty more of them, but they're all the same team, basically. Only Luton Town, Sheffield United, and Salernitana have conceded more goals than Atletico Madrid, 36, in all competitions in 2024. And it was one of the most painful ones for Atletico, because oftentimes in years gone past they would have gotten a tough draw, and it's kind of hard to see them beating maybe a Bayern or someone like that, and or whoever the draw threw them out. Whereas this one, it couldn't have been any friendlier, and I say that based on the fact that the Dortmund were the weakest team in that. I'll check up on our power rankings, the Opta power rankings now, but I would imagine that Dortmund aren't anywhere near those other teams. Like, they could have gotten Bayern, they could have gotten City, all the other teams. And yeah, it was, they go 2-0 down, had to make the changes, and then get 2-0, draw 2-2, and they're going through at that point. And it was like so he started, and it looked similar to what they did in the first leg in terms of the way that they were moving. Llorente was pushing out to make it a three-man attack when they were pressing out of possession, but it was far deeper, so they weren't actually trying to get the ball as high up the pitch. And that meant that Dortmund were more comfortable on the ball. And then he played Azpilicueta. So Samuel Lino, who we spoke about last week and saying how important he was, And obviously Simeone realized that because he tried to play Azpilicueta in a complete, in order to completely change the dynamic of that position, that area, which it did, and not for the better, because this isn't, and I think that in terms of, did he get the approach wrong? I think he did, because play Riquelme there, because that's how they've been playing all season. And you're trying to, the effect that you're trying to provoke by playing Azpilicueta is be more defensive solidly. You don't get as much going forward, but you're more solid defensively. But you can't, they just don't defend well. It's systematic, it's in on an individual level, and it, those two things intertwine, and they work off each other and are a result of each other. So you can't just become defensively better by plugging in Azpilicueta there. And I think that he had to change then at halftime, brought on Riquelme, brought on Barrios, brought on brought off Morata for Correa, and so the point is that defensively they struggle, and it's both individual and it's systematic. I'm like, just going forward now, Jamie, real quickly, what do you see as the solution here?
I honestly don't, to be honest. It feels like the summer is going to be so big for Atletico, and I wouldn't like to be the guy who's in charge of making the signings to try and get Atletico back to a level where they can compete for La Liga and deep in the Champions League. It just feels like there's a lot of work to be done there. And again, funds aren't going to be there, so they might have money to make one big signing, but what do you do? Do you buy a central midfielder to help Koke out? Do you buy a central defender to try and, you know, get better actual defenders back in there, because they've struggled this season, especially away from home, you know, the amount of goals they conceded. I honestly don't know, to be honest, and I fear for them going forward in terms of staying in contention for the big titles. But again, in this match, all four goals came in that channel between Witsel and the wing back. Witsel has had a good season, but again, on the biggest stage, when they needed it most, there were breakdowns there. And we spoke about the one for Fulkrug's goal, where inexplicably Witsel just comes charging out of the back line, opens up a lane for Dortmund to run in behind, which they did well. Sabitzer and Julian Brandt did that well all game. And you're just thinking, you know, we know Atletico are not peak Simeone Atletico in a defensive sense anymore, but why are things like that happening on such a big night when the attention to detail should absolutely be there?
Yeah, and we had this discussion then about that, because I feel like, firstly, Witsel is a centre midfielder, and that kind of spirit in him, or the reason why he is a centre midfielder, is because of the way that he sees the game. And that you can hide that, or not hide it, but you can. There are some players who can switch it on and off, and they can understand. And Witsel does that 95% of the time, and he's played very well at centre-back. And the qualities he has that makes him a centre midfielder actually can help as a centre-back. But then, occasionally, the centre midfielder comes in, he gets excited and becomes a central midfielder again and rushes out, and that's on Witsel, which is fair enough. But I think the reason for that is because he was aware that Koke wasn't quick enough to close the player coming forward with the ball, so Witsel felt like it was his responsibility to do that. It's still Witzel's fault, but I think this comes back to exactly why Simeone is playing a 5-3-2 to begin with, is because they lost Rodri, they lost Thomas Partey, then Dogbia never really convinced, and they don't have a number five. And they've been playing Koke there, which is great on the ball and in possession, but you're losing massively in out of possession. And the first goal was a result of Koke not being able to move quickly enough laterally. And it's a shame to say it, but it's those physical limitations that are causing not all the problems. And I said it's the very reason why Simeone played the 5-3-2. It's not the only reason, but it's one of the main reasons why he went to a 5-3-2. Another one was because of the left back situation, and he wanted a wing back, but he didn't have a left full back who could play both, and on. But the point about Koke and a number five and a defensive midfielder stands, and this is why Atletico are in the position that they're in with the 5-3-2, and both and another one is because now and here's a question for you: does he trust Nahuel Molina?
I don't think so. I don't think he can. To be honest, I mean, yeah. If you think about the most polarizing players in Spanish football, I think Molina and Rodrigo de Paul, not just because they're both Argentinians and they kind of go together, but the pair of them, you switch on Atletico and you don't know if you're getting a 9 out of 10 or a 4 out of 10 with those two. And yeah, we've seen him put Llorente in at wing back quite a few times this season because the confidence level just isn't there with Molina. Yeah, and I think that's a big part of Atletico being inconsistent this season. There are players, in the past, there are players that Simeone, he could count on a very steady level without being, you know, outstanding. Just a very steady level, doing the basics well, not making a huge amount of mistakes. And then you have players now that, you know, I'll probably throw Morata in with that as well. You know, I was gonna
come on to him in a second. Yeah.
I mean, he's had a decent season in terms of goal return, but again, big moment in this tie, 1-on-1, 5 minutes in. The look on Simeone's face when he kind of scoops the shot wide. Oh, it's just like,
what
oh my,
he doing?
My goodness. And then hooked at half time. So again, it's like, oh, not many players that you can really hang your hat on besides Griezmann. Koke in terms of his leadership at least.
Yeah. And through that team you couldn't, and I think that this is the issue. And he said after quite pointedly what we were looking for by changing Morata for Correa was exactly what we were lacking in the first half. And that's basically saying you have to finish that chance. They score that, the game changes completely. And it's a one-on-one chance, and he doesn't even hit the target. And I think that this is another issue that they're faced with. He changes Molina, and like you look at say someone like Joao Cancelo for Barcelona. Okay, not his finest season by any stretch, and plenty of criticism coming his way, and probably deservedly so. But Xavi is sticking with him. A, because he knows that this is his best option, and B, because he knows that if I start changing and switching him and he loses confidence, and then the other player that's coming in to replace him isn't as good and he's not getting rhythm, and then when I do play, and this is what Atletico are like with maybe four positions in that team, where Molina understands that he's not really trusted as the right back, and you have that in a couple of different positions. Likewise with Oblak, I think Simeone understands now that Oblak's limitations when he was a world-class shot stopper were fine because A, they weren't trying to play out from the back, and B, his shot stopping saved them. And whereas now they are trying to play out from back, which is a net negative with Oblak there, and his shot stopping isn't where it used to be. So they're looking at that going, well, what are you bringing to the party here? So, like you said, and then there was a report came out then right after that game saying basically Atletico, it's going to be a complete revolution in the summer. Mosquera from Valencia has been talked about. And then it's kind of like you referenced NBA earlier. It's like the NFL draft. You've got the first pick in the draft, but you've got a team with holes everywhere. What do? Do you trade down and try to pick up six quality players that could contribute in different ways and fill out the squad, or do you go for a big signing and hope for the best that player turns you into a more competitive team? What do Atletico do here? Like you said, they don't have the funds, might have the funds for one big player, but is that going to help? It's against Girona just a couple of days before the weekend, they pressed well, and they recorded a season high for high turnovers that ended with five shots, and including a goal. And that version of Atletico, where everything's going smoothly, compared with this version of Atletico versus Dortmund, where it felt like once the game broke open, it was mayhem, it was chaos.
Yeah.
And if you were to say to me, at 2-2, if you were to say to me that Atletico Madrid can't even get a draw out of this, they're going to concede 2 here. I would, because I know what Atletico are like. But Diego Simeone of yesteryear, he would not. That would not happen. They wouldn't even get a shot on. They wouldn't get 2 shots. I would bet on them not getting 2 shots on goal, let alone getting scoring 2 goals from defensive calamities. But yeah. Anyway, we're gonna have to do an autopsy on this. In deep, and maybe get a guest on later on in the season or in the summer.
Not much else to add on. Let's go. You did mention the Girona game at the weekend. It's strange how they could go from being so good on the front foot against a good Girona side, again channeling the game in their favour through aggression, to then, you know, even Michel was saying after the game how good Atletico are at mixing up the approaches, pressing high, going man to man, and then dropping off in the deep block. And it's like, maybe they can do it at home in one-off games, but to do it, you know, across league, Europe, away from home, they just don't have the capacity there to do it, the options. And I wonder as well if maybe against Girona they burnt a few too many matches, because that was a very aggressive, you know, energetic performance for a long time. And I was thinking, I was looking at Griezmann a bit in the second leg in Dortmund and thinking, is he all there? Is he a little bit not hobbled, but lacking sharpness? Because that was a big effort against Girona, I thought.
Yeah, and I'd say, looking at the way that Atletico set up, I think they were probably thinking and hoping and expecting that they could contain Dortmund, and maybe a 1-1 would do them, or a 0-0 potentially. But then they got 2 goals, and it's like, hold on, this isn't turning out the way that, like, they thought they could go hell for leather against Girona, and then maybe contain the game against Dortmund. And this is exactly the problem. Atletico trying to contain anyone anymore is a non-runner, and it's just going to end in tears for everyone involved in Atletico. But speaking of Michel, just say, got a notification on my phone, and I'm trying to teach you, Jamie. I try to disperse my wisdom upon you, and you need to listen to me, because at the start of the year, I said Michel for Manchester City, and I won't say that you went as far as sneering. You didn't sneer; that would be unfair. But no. I think you chuckled or you giggled behind your mic there. But now I just got a notification saying that City are planning their a future without Guardiola, and not maybe this summer, but they're thinking ahead, and Michel is among the candidates. So that would be a quite a rise to the highest, literally the highest level of the game for Michel after his meteoric rise with Girona. So no, I know I was joking there. I know that you really like Michel and that, but it was really far fetched to me, and I have said some ridiculous things in the past. So you're probably right not to listen to me, but I just kind of I said I'd throw that one in.
Yeah, I mean, it would be nice to see Michel with some proper defenders who can defend. I'll say that. I did say I would pick Michel for the Barcelona job if that was at all possible. But again, yeah, that was a little jive at Girona's defending. But yeah, Will
Daily Blind out here catching strays, and it's the Champions League pod. They haven't even made it to the Champions League yet, and he's already catching strays.
I love Girona's defenders, but yeah, they're lacking on the defensive side, and that has manifested this second half of the season.
Yeah. We're gonna talk about Girona in a couple of weeks. I said a couple of weeks ago that I was nervous about them not making the top four, and I'm increasingly nervous. But let's see how that one pans out. But yeah, we'll finish off here on Man City and Real Madrid. We've already spoken about it. 4-4 on aggregate, 3-4 on penalties to Real Madrid as the away side, and 1-1 on the night. I mean, Yeah, we're just going to rehash what we said here. Fede Valverde summed it up perfectly after the game. He said, they obviously played better football than us, but we're Real Madrid. And if ever the myth of Real Madrid had manifested itself in something that you could actually cash in, this was it. It's their reputation now precedes them. They're world class individually, but it does feel like they are lacking in certain ways. But Jude Bellingham also said after the game that basically he said some teams are a bit more structured in terms of their passing styles and the patterns of play, and it's really interesting to watch, and it's definitely difficult to play against. But I think one of our biggest strengths is that we're so off the cuff. And we spoke about that last week, about how it's almost difficult to plan for them because you don't know how they're going to press you because it is off the cuff. You don't really know how they're going to attack you because it's so off the cuff. And we saw this again in that, okay, they sat and soaked up an awful lot of pressure against City, but they come out alive. And now I don't think there's anyone betting against them winning this thing.
No, you'd have to feel invincible having got past Man City in that fashion. And the defending, again, we spoke about it initially, but it was incredible. If you accept the fact that if you defend for 90, 100 minutes, whatever it was, you're facing 30 shots. You know, Man City had 81 touches in the opposition box. If you accept there's going to be probably one, two moments where, you know, you might have been lucky to not concede, the defending otherwise was just exceptional. And it's hard to pick out individual performances in a game like this, but I thought Dani Carvajal probably had one of his best ever games for Real Madrid. The demand he was under up against Grealish on a yellow card, and then they sling on Doku as well, to stand up to that threat the way that he did was just inspirational stuff. And again, you can probably pick out every single defender across the back line, every midfielder with the job they did as well. But just something about Real Madrid, the way they didn't plan for a game to be that extreme, but once the pattern had set in, it's like they're not going to be rattled by it. They're just going to accept the way the game has gone and respond to it in the best way they can. And you think of Barcelona, I know they went down to 10 men, but they were 5 minutes from getting to half time with their lead still intact. And João Cancelo completely switches off at the back post. And it's just the levels of seriousness, attention to detail, just levels of competitiveness are just were there in abundance for Real Madrid and lacking in Barcelona, just to use an example.
Exactly. And there is also that part of me, like I mentioned earlier, I don't really understand. I always have a weird feeling after these games, because in some ways I'm like, that's incredible. This is why we watch football. It's just the biggest night and the craziest ending. We've been offered 90 minutes of a game between two of the best teams in the world with the very best players in the world. Then we get an extra 30 minutes, all sorts of storylines, and then penalties that were crazy. But there's also this weird feeling, and you're kind of just trying to make sense of it in your head. And you're also kind of not looking forward to the analysis after, because a lot of the Spanish media, Real Madrid just did, they're amazing. It's Real Madrid and that's it. And it's kind of like, okay, but we need more than that. It can't, like, and it's happened too many times now for this to not be something. But I can't put my finger on it either. So it's kind of a weird feeling after. And I was glad when you sent me that message to send your head for a spin, because in one way, Carvajal, unbelievable. And his season in general, when it was an area of concern for us going into the season, that right back position that we brought up, but he has just been lights out. There's a part of me also wondering and questioning Pep Guardiola's style, in that he's knocked the boldness, the brashness, the creativity out of a lot of these players, but that Grealish never even really tried to take Carvajal on. He's not an enjoyable player to watch, certainly, and I don't watch him every week, so maybe he does it in the Premier League, But in this night, it's like, go at Carvajal, take him on, try to provoke something. But it was just like, no, we're going to control this completely because we don't want to be countered on, and we're just going to bore them to death, and not bore them to death. We're going to control the game to the point where they're just going to make one mistake, and that's all we need. But then you're just sitting there, and it's like, this is Real Madrid just keep on knocking knocking you back. And once Kevin De Bruyne went off, then it felt like they're not going to score here, and they're the better team clearly, but they're not scoring here. On Real Madrid's side, then they did really well to cut out that Foden cutting in from the right, nullified Bernardo Silva basically, and Rodrigo, and Haaland. But he's another player who I would criticize, but at the same time, Real Madrid defended him unbelievably well throughout the 180 minutes plus 30. And so, on one part of me, you'd be critical of Pep, thinking you needed to try something different. But on the other side, it's like Real Madrid are just inevitable at the same time.
Yeah, I think I don't really have too much to say against Pep in a game like this. I think there's a lot of merit in being able to pen Real Madrid in to this extent. I know they didn't get the breakthrough that they needed to win the game. But again, I mean, this is one of the great defensive resistances in Champions League history. I mean, we only have the data since 03, 04, but, you know, using the field tilt metric to show the possession in the final thirds, you know, this was the highest since, you know, Barcelona-Chelsea in... I've lost the tweet now, but yeah, Barca-Chelsea in 2012, I think it was. And then the one before that was Mourinho's famous resistance at the Camp Nou against Barcelona. So this... You know, both of those teams had 10 men in those games as well. So 11v11, it's possible that a resistance like this has never happened with such domination of territory. But again, I think if there's one thing I'd say about Man City is they played Guardiola again and Akanji in midfield areas. Like you said, they were nervous about transitions. They wanted to shut those down. But with the territory they had, I was watching it and almost thinking, is it possible you've got too much territory? Because there's almost no space for your midfielders to get involved here. And on the edge of the box, it felt like the ball was constantly at the feet of Guardiola and Akanji having to make decisions, who are natural defenders, as we know. And again, yeah, it would have been nicer, I think, to maybe sacrifice one of those players, maybe Akanji, put Bernardo into his position and get an extra midfielder on, whether it was Alvarez, Mateus Nunes, Doku earlier, I don't know. But again, it's one of those games where for everything we say, again, if they play it 10 times, maybe Man City progress on 9 occasions. But
yeah,
I see you again, El Madrid.
Exactly, yeah. That's just how Madrid win. And yeah, like you were saying with the field tilt, and then 88 touches in the opposition box for Man City compared to 12 for Real Madrid. Man City had 18 corners, and at one point in the first half, they had felt like about 13 in a row, and just kept going out for a corner. And then, yeah, between the 25th and 106th minute, Real Madrid's only shot was a Rodrigo effort from range. And I think it's like you said, can you have too much territory? And I think this is probably why I'm critical of Pep's has been for, he's got such an amount of choices now and such high quality that it's actually turned his creativity in on itself. He doesn't need to be as creative as he once was, because he just thinks if we control the game enough, we will win this because we have enough quality and etc. etc. Whereas in the past, when he was at Barcelona starting out, and that he had to get more inventive in order to beat teams. And I think that is, yeah, they just feel like they can control games to death. And we saw that how that doesn't happen, especially against Real Madrid. And the point about Grealish and Doku, maybe because Grealish, I feel like Carvajal has his number and has pretty much cancelled him out most times they played. Maybe Doku instead of Grealish, or maybe like we said on the pod last week about Alvarez instead of Haaland, but instead he went with Haaland and we just saw the same as what we've seen pretty much every time Haaland has played against Real Madrid. Kind of hoping for a different result, and like you said, you play that game 10 times, they probably win it 7, 8, 9 times. But I don't have any other explanation other than that. But I was watching it, thinking about the, and we were watching it and looking at the way there was no space for midfielders, and the Man City were just kind of, they were literally on the edge of Real Madrid's box, passing it back and forth to each other. And me and my mate who was watching it, it was actually funny watching it, thinking, well, this is just so weird. Like, this is one of the weirdest games. They're defending in their own box. They're not really putting pressure on, but City, it feels like we're in a time warp. It just, City are just holding the ball. And so it was just completely bizarre match. And Real Madrid end up coming out on top.
Yeah, I really hope we don't have to do this again against Bayern in the semi-finals, where it's, you know, just another half inexplicable, half you know, incredible resistance. I would like to see Real Madrid play not play a different tie, but I really hope we get different game against Bayern over both legs, where it's a little bit more balanced, and we see. Not less transitions from Real Madrid, but more responsibility to take the ball and try and break the game down, which, you know, we've enjoyed watching them this season. The Bellingham quote you referenced earlier, the creativity that they have in attack, that, you know, Real Madrid can perfectly win a semi-final tie without having to rely on transitions and defending deep. So again, let's just hope we get a different style game in semi-finals.
Yeah, so that's our way of explaining the inexplicable there. We can't really do much better than that. And I hope that the cognitive dissonance that you're all feeling after that game, and every year, it seems, with Real Madrid in the Champions League, I hope that has subsided at least a little bit, and know that you're not alone when you're trying to analyze this game or think about this game or try to make sense of this game, because it just doesn't make any sense. Although we have tried to do it there over the last few minutes. But look, we're going to leave it there. Myself and Jamie, we're going to be back after the Clásico with a special guest on Tuesday. And we're going to be discussing Barcelona mainly, but obviously depending on how it goes, we're going to be talking about Real Madrid too and how they approach that one. They could wrap up La Liga pretty much, even if it's not wrapped up already. But yeah, as I said, we're going to leave it there for now. And from myself and Jamie, on this episode of La Pausa Pod, it is adios.